Guess number 9722.
Miss Sullivan, Reel 5.
I approached George Aitken, who was the brigade commissar on that front, and told him that this man, in my opinion, was no use and should be taken to the rear, away from frontline duty. And to my surprise, Aitken agreed. He was very understanding. He'd been in the First World War himself, had been wounded, and I thought it was very, very good of him, because you have to be very hard during a war. You can't just sort of fit everybody in who might feel they can't carry on, otherwise you'd have nobody left.
What else did the job involve as commissar?
Oh, seeing there was a fair ration of food and that sort of thing, and seeing that people on the Jarama, we started having leave to Madrid, because the front was more or less quiet, and to arrange people to go on leave. And in the early period, they were given 7 days leave in Madrid, but quite a number didn't come back, because there was all kinds of organizations in Madrid and in Spain which were helping people to desert. I don't know if you're aware of this, but one organization that was very active in this was the Scottish Medical Aid Unit. And then I read the memoirs of a British agent who was stationed in Valencia or somewhere, who also carried out this work, in the sense that deserters who would get to the coast would find it no difficulty in getting onto a British freighter, you know, and being sent back home, quite a number.
Were you aware of that organisation of deserters at the time?
No, I only found out afterwards by reading about this and reading memoirs of people who were involved in the British intelligence out there. Obviously, everybody had people out there. I mean, I only just learned now, there was a man I came across in hospital, Viscount Churchill, who now has been revealed as an agent of British intelligence out there. That's all right, everybody was doing it. Another factor I remember, one of my good points, when we were leaving the village of Mondejar, when we rested after the Jarama, prior to going into battle again up Brunetti. Now the villagers gave each company 2 trays of peaches as a parting gift. Now the other companies, the commissars of the other companies, started dishing out the peaches at one go, you know. But I was a bit more cautious, more prudent, and I reserved one case for later on. And during the hot journey, you know, it's during July, beginning of July, it's very, very warm, and I then went round and gave everybody else a peach each, so I was really tops with the lads when the other people were very jealous about this other company having another round of peaches. Things like that. And but really, the commander was the commander, the military commander.
Now, after the period of your hospitalisation,
yes.
What work did you take up after that?
Well, when I was, you see, at the time, you didn't think there was an organisation behind you, you know, people with records and etc., etc., but obviously there was. So my record must have been that, right, this man had been twice wounded, he'd been here since November, late November 1936, this is now the autumn of 1937, he's not at the front, and I left the convalescent hospital at Salaces, and I was sent to Tarazona, which isn't very far from Albacete, and I was given the job there of being in charge of the messing for the men, for the other ranks. There was somebody else in charge of the officers. And from there, after a period, I was sent to Albacete, where I joined a man named Hercules Avgerinus, who was a Londoner and a Greek Cypriot, middle class bloke, public school, and that sort of thing. And he was in charge of a little department called the Cadre Department.
The what?
Cadre. C-A-D-R-E. Which dealt with tracing people, where they were, and interviewing the volunteers as they came to Albacete. But this was late 1937, and I used to go down to the barracks where the new arrivals would come and take their details. And then they'd be processed and go through and they'd leave our hands. And I did that for some time. But it really come to a trickle by the end of 1937, being in 1938. And in March 1938, I had officer rank, and there were, by this time there were separate messes for officers, and I was permitted to live in private quarters, you know, not in any billet or barracks, which I did do. And in March, about the middle of March, I was told I was being repatriated. It was a big surprise to me because I wouldn't dare to ask to be sent back home. And I was repatriated along with a man named John Henderson, who was badly wounded at Brunetti. He had been the postman on the front at Harama. He was a Geordie who was living, when he returned to England, in Melton Mowbray, I think. And we were being repatriated, and we had to go to Valencia, make our own way there as best as we could, and present ourselves at the delegation of the International Brigades, a Spanish organisation of some kind, to get a salvo conducto. Now, by this time, middle of March, the Franco forces were driving through the Aragon to cut Spain in two, as they did. And we left Valencia and moved to a place called Castellón de la Plana, which is on the coast there, somewhere a bit higher up Valencia. And by this time there was crowds and crowds of peasant refugees streaming from the interior, coming to the coast to get away from the advancing fascist forces. And we went to the edge of the town where the Carabinieri, we showed them our salvo conducto, and they stopped a lorry which was piled, it was a Swiss lorry, which was piled high with cases of oranges. It was like a great big square on top, and it took us all our efforts to climb. The only way you can get on that lorry, there was no room in the front, there was other people in the front, and the lorry driver had to take us, because Carabinieri told him, providing we climbed to the top of the lorry. And the lorry, all the load was secured with ropes. And we got to the top of the lorry, did Henderson and myself. And we travelled from the afternoon, it's a long distance to Barcelona from there. And we travelled through the night, stopped about 3 a.m. somewhere on the road, lit a fire, and got warm or something like that. And in the morning we arrived in Barcelona on March the 16th. I remember the date because that was the commencement of a 3-day aerial bombardment by Italian Air Force, dropping bombs at regular intervals on Barcelona. Now, it was the first time, a great open city. Guernica had been bombed one afternoon, but this was the first time when over 48 hours, spread over 3 days, that a city was being bombed from the air with no retaliation. There was no aircraft, no anti-aircraft. It all coincided with the thrust which shortly afterwards brought them to the Mediterranean, Franco forces. And we couldn't move from Barcelona because all trains to the frontier were stopped, all trains anywhere were stopped. And after 3 days, we journeyed to the frontier along with a group of about 10 Alsace Lorraine International Brigade men who had also been repatriated. And we finally got to a place called Port Bou, which is on the frontier of Spain and France, and we crossed under the international tunnel with a train which only ran that 200 yards and passed into France, where we were met by a representative. They must have gone there every day at this station to meet international brigade men returning. And we were taken by this bloke to the station buffet for a lunch. And I remember the meal. It was grilled chops and salted potatoes and coffee. Now, the coffee we'd been having was made from ersatz from burnt wheat. And it was only 200 yards away from Port Boo, where we'd spent most of the day waiting for this train to take us under the front, under the Pyrenees, under the tunnel. And the only thing we couldn't get any food. There was no food available. Spain was starving, 1938. And we managed to get a cup of coffee, of this horrible ersatz coffee, burnt wheat. And just 200 yards away, later on, we're sitting down to a lovely meal and real coffee. And that contrast remained with me. You know, that here was another world. And there was war-stricken Spain, starving and being defeated. And here was the democracies doing nothing more or less, Britain and France. And very shortly after that, within the year, you know, there was the Second World War.
Did you ever go back to Spain?
I didn't go back to Spain. I must tell you the truth. I spent a winter holiday in Portugal on the Algarve, before the Algarve was discovered, you know. And I was fed up this hotel. I was staying there for 6 weeks in the winter. And I thought I'd go... It was terrible weather. And I thought I'd go to southern Spain, to Malaga. And I crossed... No... That's another occasion, I'm telling you. That was a time when I was travelling around southern Europe. It was, Franco was still living in power. And I moved from the Algarve. I thought I'd go into southern Spain. And I went to Seville. And I thought I'd go to Malaga, but I couldn't get a train. It was full. You had to book the day before, which I didn't know. And I went to Gibraltar. And I finally flew home from Gibraltar, but I didn't really see Spain. I just travelled from to get to you know, somewhere. But I went back to Spain in 1978. I had a friend who was not in the International Brigade, but his friend had gone to Spain and got killed. He had been a young actor in the West End of London, this friend of mine, and so had his friend had been a young actor, and this friend had gone to Spain and was killed. And this chap, who is a middle-class bloke, this friend of mine, who came to the seminar on the open day in Loughborough, seeking information about his friend. This has happened a lot, by the way, of people seeking information about someone they knew who went to Spain, got killed, and know nothing about them. And we agreed to go back to Spain and to visit the fronts I'd been at. And we did. I travelled right. We hired a car in Spain, in Madrid, and we travelled to the Jarama, then we went to Andalusia. From Andalusia we went to Las Rosas in Madrid, and I spent a very interesting time with this bloke, and we had a friend in Madrid whom I'd met in Manchester, and he was excellent, taking us around Madrid, Segovia and all over. I had a very interesting trip on that occasion in 1978. And of course I went back last year in the autumn, October of last year, to attend the 50th anniversary celebration of the founding of the International Brigades, which was again very interesting because you had representatives from different European countries. You had a large crowd from the USA, about over 300, of which about 110 were former veterans, the rest were wives and relatives or people interested in this Spanish Civil War. And it was a momentous occasion. Now, I stayed on for a further week. I went on to the Aragon and Barcelona because a film unit, the more or less, adopted me And I was the only Englishman who went over to sort of battlefronts of the Aragon, which I'd never visited before. Places like Gandesa, Belchite, which is something really. That's been left as a total ruin under the orders of Franco. And that is something to see. And Caspi, and I visited all those fronts. And on this occasion, for the first time, the American media now were there in force. The principal television company, CBC, ABC, and whatever the other one was called, and they covered it. And I remember talking to one cameraman from the CBC, and he'd come from Beirut. He'd been called over. See, these film units are stationed already in Europe, most of them, and they're switched over. He says, "By God," he says to me, "I'm damn glad to get away from Beirut," he says, you know. And and I was with this little Anglo-American team that was hoping to do a film for Channel 4. And somehow they got very friendly with me in Madrid, and they asked me to accompany them, and I did do it. And they did a very long tape with me in Barcelona. One of them was a producer for the BBC, who was incognito because he was not supposed to work for anybody else. But the man who was running the whole show got in touch with him, and he got in touch with another cameraman. And there was a team of four, and myself made five. And they did a lot of taping, you know, shooting film and so on, with the Americans there on the, and myself.
Now, can you say something about what you personally witnessed of the Russian contribution to the Spanish?
Well, I'll tell you a very interesting. At Murata del Tajunio, as I told you, I was at the in this village just behind the line, about 3/4 mile behind the line, in the first few days, what do you call it. Now, I was the political responsible, the delegate for this little unit of people who had been in the first English company, who had fought in these two fronts. And we had two cooks with us who had not been at the front before. You know, we had a field kitchen in the opening land. And half a dozen men came up, and I was told about them to go and see them. And they wore black leather coats, long coats. And they came up and they asked me, could we give them some food? And I could see they were not they were not English, they were not French, they were not, what do you call it, look. They're not Russian, Slavic to me. I said, Ruskies. No. Czechoslovakia. They were not. They were Russian tank crews who were in the area. And I ordered these two cooks to break open some tins of corned beef and make some rissoles, you know, and make some coffee and give them a meal. They were the only Russians I ever saw or met.
But how did you know they were Russians?
They were Russians, definitely. They were not International Brigade men. They were not. They wore black leather, long black leather coats, which tank men wore at that period, I believe, you see. And they were Russians. Because they wouldn't have been there, you understand me? They had parked their tank somewhere near the village and walked into the village. Hmm? Looking for a meal. Because there were Russian tanks on that front.
Now, at the time of the Spanish Civil War, there was a great controversy between the Communist Party and the so-called ultra-left about this issue of whether or not the war, whether the war should be given priority,
right,
or whether the so-called revolution,
yes,
should be pushed
well,
forward.
Well, I know something about that.
Were you conscious of that issue at the time you were there?
Well, I'll tell you.
Was that ever discussed?
On the 50th anniversary of the Spanish Civil War, there was a full-page article in The Guardian by some professor, who incidentally knew, was at college with Cornford, because I have corresponded with him in the past in Edinburgh, professor of history or something like that.
Victor Kiernan.
That's the man. Victor Kiernan. You know, I'm getting old and my memory is not so right, but it comes to me eventually. Victor Kiernan. And I corresponded with him some years ago, and I'd sent him something I'd written, you know, and he gave me one or two hints. He said, use more, because I only went to school till I was 14, and he says, use more commas, you know, and that sort of thing. Right. Now, as a result of that letter, there was a letter following that from somebody from Freedom Press in London, Whitechapel, Emily, an anarchist, a woman, who brought up this very question about the communist sort of sacrificed the social revolution, etc., etc., the line of the anarchists and the ultra-left. Now, I wrote a letter, I was incensed at this, and I immediately filed a letter off to the Guardian, which they published, you see, and refuting this, in which I pointed out that when we were at the front, when I was at the front on the Harama and elsewhere, I never asked a soldier next to me what were his political affiliations, and whether was he fighting for the revolution, or fighting for this, that, or fighting to win the war. I said, I never asked that, and we were not concerned. All I knew that as a soldier at the front, I was fighting to win the war. Anything else that came afterwards wasn't my concern. And this holds good for very much. When I first read George Orwell's book, Homage to Catalonia, I bought the first edition, which today is a very much sought after book, and which sums of money in three figures are easily available by American universities for it, because only 800 were printed. And I had the first edition. And I read this story by George Orwell. And I was so disgusted about this front on the Aragon, which was quiescent all that time when we were losing lives on the Jarama, Brunetti, La Pera, and Las Rosas de Madrid. The front where he was quiescent. It was a joke. It was a joke. You see, and here him is criticising the role of the Communist Party, you know, and whereas the people he was connected with the POM or the anarchists or the CNT were wanted to ensure the social revolution. To me, that was ridiculous. Here was a country at war, and these other people, for ideological reasons, were putting a spoke in the wheel. They were controlling Barcelona. When I was in Barcelona, everything was the CNT, you know, I mean, on my way home. You know, the telephone could build in everything else, all that sort of thing. And, I mean, they'd been ousted by then, 1938. But on arriving there in 1936, it was anarchist controlled. In fact, on the train that brought me from Figueres to Barcelona, this small group of us, on the train, we were apprehended by a man who came into the carriage, and he says, papers. So we looked at him, and to make sure that he had some, he turned back the lapel of his jacket, and there was a badge of the CNT or the FAI or something like that. He was an official, you see. So we told him who we were, etc., etc. They controlled everything. This is now late 1936, in November.
36.
Hmm?
36.
No, 36. I'm talking about arriving there.
Yep.
36. I arrived in November 1936. Right. So they control. And when I read Orwell, I thought I was disgusted. And much to my regret now, I threw the book in the dustbin. I was that, because it was shortly after, you know, and I just threw it in the dustbin. I was sorry, because I should have kept it.
But, so you never, amongst you, the International Brigade people, you never discussed this issue then?
In Spain, part of the role of the commissars and the commanders, now this was way before Montgomery ever ran these sessions with his commanders and officers to detail what the offensive was going to be about and why it was taking place, etc. We had that already in Spain. That before the Brunetti offensive, I was called to a meeting as a commissar, along with the commander of the company, to a big gathering in which it was given out in several languages, you see, detailing what was going to take place so that we should tell our men, put them in the picture too. And this was something that was already being done in Spain, which was later followed out, as far as I can know, by Montgomery in the Second World War.
And
see, we're not using them as just, you know, a lot of stupid and cannon fodder.
To your recollection, did nobody in the International Brigade bring up what is now identified as the ultra-left line?
No. Not as far as I can remember. No. I don't think we knew very much about it. We had on the Harama, this is when it took place in 1937, in the spring, May 1937, and we used to have a cyclist-styled news sheet sent every day to the troops in the front line. And it did mention that this trouble was taking place in Barcelona, this element, you know, but we just sort of... We knew there were so many different parties, political parties in Spain, and there wasn't such a lot. And the Communist Party was getting stronger and stronger as each month went by. But it didn't relate to us a great deal, you know, that this was a big struggle that was taking place in Barcelona, because we were already in the front.
But did you feel that in some way it was a stab in the back?
No, I didn't. No, I don't know. I don't know. I didn't feel it that way. No.
Now, going back to when you were leaving England, did you come across any opposition by the British Customs about getting out?
No, but I had opposition on returning.
Can you tell me about it?
Yes. Now, don't forget, there was only two men returning. That's Henderson and myself, and we both had passports. Now, when we arrived at Folkestone, we had to show our passports in France, of course, you know, leaving the port and so on. When we arrived in Folkestone, we were told to go to a certain exit. And there was two men there, no uniform, just dressed in, what do you call it. They looked at our passports, and they knew we had just come from Spain. See? And they only uttered one sentence. They said, two more bloody reds back. And that's all they said. Now, I know, of course, that I was on the records of the MI5, obviously, because I had a great deal of discrimination when I was in the Second World War in the army. And that's another long story, see, which I'm not going to... It's not necessary. But that they only said that two more bloody reds back, and that was that, and off we went.
You mentioned earlier that about the importance of making sure that no infiltrators or provocateurs got into the ranks of the International
yes.
Brigade. Whilst you were serving in the International Brigade, were any infiltrators or provocateurs discovered or suspected? Apart from de La Salle, whom you mentioned.
Yes. Well, I cannot say about the British Battalion, but I do know a lot of people deserted. Are you aware of the number that deserted?
No.
I don't know what I should tell you this, but I think... although Alexander has written a history of the British Battalion, euphemistically calls them people returning without permission. In my book, I call them deserters. There was actually 300 who returned without permission, and you can find all this in the Public Records Office.
Have you researched it?
No, but I've seen the result that this has been researched.